This is New America Now, dispatches from the new majority. I'm Shireen Sadeghi. Coming up, 1 year after the earthquake, what are the lessons learned in Haiti?
You cannot count on the international community right now to give you money to rebuild your country.
Iranian Americans react to news of a fallen prince.
This young man couldn't be a prince and couldn't be a regular person, and that was the problem here.
The Taste of a Name. Writer Monique Trong's new book is bitter in the mouth.
Her first name, Linda, makes her taste mint. Her last name, Hamrick, makes her taste root beer.
Did the events in Arizona finally bring Republicans and Democrats together?
I suppose I side with the conservative line now that Sarah Palin did not pull the trigger.
Jean-Yves Point du Jour, better known as Yves Daïti, is the host of Konbit Lakai, a radio program based in Washington, D.C. that is geared toward the Haitian-American community. For 27 years, he has been a figurehead in the Haitian-American community, a voice from the homeland and a father figure for a community that is this week honoring the victims of the earthquake that left Haiti in tatters exactly 1 year ago. Welcome to the show, Mr. Point du Jour.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, tell us where Haiti stands a year after the earthquake.
It's not a good picture. A year after the earthquake, we're still in the same situation that we are in a year ago. We have approximately 1.5 million people homeless. They're still living under tents throughout the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, even in the poor provinces. And we don't know when they're going to have a permanent place or a home to live. The international community has promised money to help rebuild Haiti, but so far it's all empty air, and it has not been materialized. Not only that, the Haitian people themselves, they feel frustrated because things are going slow. But at the same time, those who are making decisions, they are also frustrated because they don't like the direction that the Interim Reconstruction Commission, headed by former President Bill Clinton, is heading. For example, they think that many of those decisions are being taken without Haitians participating. And it's our country, and we think that we should be the one to decide how we want our country to be rebuilt. But so far, this has not been happening. And at the last Reconstruction Commission meeting in Santo Domingo, in the Dominican Republic, even the Prime Minister was not there. And the Prime Minister of Jamaica, the former Prime Minister of Jamaica, Percival Patterson, who is the representative of the CARICOM community, complained bitterly that contracts are being awarded and that there has not been any vote within the commission on those contracts. And on top of that, we have an avalanche of non-governmental organizations in the country, and no one knows exactly what's going on. And there is a lack of accountability, not only on the part of those people, and also, well, on the part of the government, too. So it's really a bleak picture of the situation of Haiti today.
Well, let me get back to that point you made about President Clinton's foundation, because the Clinton-Bush Foundation made instant and quite pervasive pleas for money from Americans to Haiti. And they're still putting ads out today, a year after the earthquake happened. Why is the U.S. government so interested in helping Haiti?
Well, the U.S. government promised Haiti $1.6 billion. But it was from the time that announcement was made. And I remember I went on the air and I told my constituents or everybody that the Haitian government, they better have a plan B, because you cannot count on the international community right now to give you money to rebuild your country. Because most of those countries, they themselves, they are broke. And U.S. gave us, I forget it was $265 million or something were allocated. That's what last figure that I heard. But we don't know what has happened to that money, how that money is being spent. And we also know that USAID claim that they have spent a lot of dollars, a lot of money. We don't know how that money is being spent. We don't have no report, no accountability.
So you have no information from your family members and friends in Haiti as to how or if at all that money is being spent to reconstruct Haiti?
And the other thing is, within that commission itself, remember, it's a lot of countries. And each one of those countries, when they give you money, they want the major part of that money to be spent on their own companies. So otherwise, it's to me, the Haitian government would have been better served by asking each one of those countries to fulfill a need inside the country, as opposed to having a commission where you expect everybody is going to be giving money in a fund, and then they're going to disperse it. So once again, we are being shortchanged.
Well, tell me where Haitian Americans stand on this issue. I mean, you're in touch with the community here in the United States. What are their concerns? What are their attitudes about what is happening a year later?
First of all, let me say that the Haitian diaspora, like the Haitian society, is also made up of a lot of fragments. We don't have a unified voice in the diaspora, although it seems that the one issue that I think all of them agree is the fact that the last election was a sham. But what has happened is we have pockets of organizations, and some of those organizations, many of them, they are run by people who are either, for example, let me give you a clear example. There was a meeting at the White House last week with, they say, with some Haitian representatives from the diaspora. Now, more than half of the people who were there at the table are people who have never taken any position on an issue regarding Haiti in the diaspora. Those people were selected, some of them, they have contracts, pending contracts, proposals in front of USAID for money, and others because they have been silent. Now, the people who have been very outspoken, and they were not basically invited. And
Why weren't they invited?
Well, I don't know. That's a question for the White House to answer. For example, my name was proposed, and they did not invite me.
That seems a bit strange. You've been an important figure in the Haitian American community.
That's right. Yeah, my name was proposed, and as a matter of fact, the person that who was organizing the meeting said, well, yeah, I know him. But I was not invited. And that has been, you know, the issue. That has been the problem. And let me give you another example. I am a transportation engineer. I have been working for the past 17 years as a transportation professional for a Department of Transportation in the country. I'm a planner. And not only that, I teach transportation. I called the State Department asking them to give me a copy of the reconstruction plan, a copy that the Miami Herald in an article said that they obtained a copy. And you know what? They never gave me a copy. You mean to tell me as Haitians, you're going to rebuild my country, and I'm asking you for a copy, and up to now you have not sent me a copy.
Why do you think they didn't send you a copy? Do you think it?
I don't know, because they think I know too much.
Are you representative of the concerns that the Haitian American community have, or do you think you're just a minority?
As a matter of fact, we are debating that, and I've been talking to some of my colleagues, and I told them it's time that we form a real diaspora organizations, a real organizations for with real people in the diaspora who knows the concern of Haiti, but who are not there for their self-interest. Because we need to really make our voices heard. We don't want them to pick people for us and tell us that those people, they represent Haitians in the diaspora. That's not true. We don't want that.
Let's switch this around. For our American audience, are primary source of information on Haiti is through the mainstream media in this country. Are you, as a Haitian American, having access to news, ethnic media or other news that is different than what is being presented in the mainstream media in this country? And what is that news? What is the news that we're not hearing?
Well, first of all, remember, we have a language barrier. Most of the news that I get from Haiti, it's in Creole. So on Saturday night, for example, when I'm giving the news, I give Haitians on Saturday night sometimes 1 hour of news. And I have to translate everything from English to Creole or from Creole to English.
Well, give me an example of some of the news that you're giving to your audience that we wouldn't hear in the mainstream media in this country.
For example,
Haiti.
The reactions of Haitians toward what the OAS, the Organization of American States, is doing in Haiti. Nobody has heard the voices of Haitians, only on my show, so complaining about the United Nations, which they think which is not helping them, complaining about the cholera thing. No one. It's only when you have a big thing that you see the press in Haiti. Other than that, you don't see the press. They don't hear the protests, the way the candidates, they are talking about the election, the reaction of the people. The U.S. citizens, they don't hear that. They don't know that. Only on my radio show on Saturday night that they hear the real voices of the people and their problems.
And what are those problems?
For example, you have rapes in the camps. You have lack of services. The question, the NGOs, what are they doing with the money that they receive? They don't get access to running water. And all those issues that no one is talking about them but us on Saturday night.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Mr. Point du Jour.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Jean-Yves Point du Jour is the host of Konbit Lakai, a Haitian-American radio program broadcast from Washington, D.C. This is New America Now. I'm Shireen Sadeghi. One year later, Haitians are still recovering from the massive earthquake. But as Isabel Allende points out in her new book, Islands Beneath the Sea, Haiti has always been a focal point of turmoil, but also of magic. She spoke with New America Media's Sandeep Roy in April of last year.
Isabel Allende, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
With this novel already at the printers and having studied so much about Haiti, and then the earthquake happens, did it make you look at the earthquake with different eyes?
With more sympathy, and I felt very close to it. But the novel had been already published a year before in Europe. So the coincidence is only in the United States with the edition in English. But I felt very close because I think I know the people in Haiti as if I had been born there. I can understand them better because of the history. They are creative, resilient, survivors, wonderful, wonderful people.
Well, Haiti, especially after the quake, when you read the media coverage, it stands out as sort of this tragic story in a way. And, you know, when you're writing about Haiti, writing about slavery, the history, did you worry that this could become the saddest story in the world?
No, because it is a wonderful story. It is not the saddest story. By the late 1700s, there were 500,000 slaves in what was then a French colony called Saint-Domingue, the richest colony that France had. And slavery had been abolished in France already, but not in the colonies. And there were 500,000 African slaves controlled by 34,000 people of color. 20,000 were whites and the other one affranchis, free people of color. And the treatment of the slaves was atrocious. They were exploited to death. They were expected to live from 4 to 6 years. And so their life was so miserable that the only chance to get out was either death or try to run away. Finally, they rebelled. And by 1804, they had created the first... It was the first slave revolt that succeeded in history. And it was the first independent republic of Latin America, the first independent Negro republic in the world.
Did you know all this when you lived in Latin America?
No. I knew very little about Haiti because Haiti is, we don't consider it Latin American because it's French. The culture is French and it's the Caribbean. So just like Jamaica, for example, is so British that we don't consider it Latin American. So the only thing I knew was that there had been a slave revolt and it had been the first independent republic, but that was it. And then when I started researching and I found out how these slaves revolted and what really happened, then it's fascinating because it has all the element that I love in writing. It has the passion, the love, the courage, survival, magic. Without voodoo and the spiritual beliefs of the slaves, you can't explain really how they succeeded in defeating the troops of Napoleon.
Well, tell us about the woman who is at the center of this book, Sarite.
When I researched both places, Haiti and New Orleans, I had all the scenario, the theater to move my characters, and I was probably ready to write the book. But I didn't feel I had the book because I didn't have the voice to tell it, to tell the story. So I wrote in between a memoir, The Sum of Our Days. And then in the process of writing that memoir, one day I woke up, I don't know if I had a dream or if I sort of saw her in that stage of when you are half awake in the morning and it's like an alpha state. Or maybe she's just a ghost that she appeared in my house. Who knows? But I saw her clearly. I saw this tall African woman with a long neck and long, very elegant hands, slanted eyes, high cheekbones, dressed in white with a voice, a deep voice, very self-centered, very quiet, very strong. And she came with a name, Sarite. So I went to Google. And Google Sarite didn't appear. So I thought, oh my God, she came with a name already. She's here. I have her voice. And then when she came, I could tell the story. So it is the story of this woman from age 9 when she's sold to a planter in Saint-Domingue.
Well, I wanted to hear a little bit in Sarite's voice. Would you mind reading a little bit? This is right from the beginning of the book when in Sarite's voice when she's looking back.
In the house where I spent my earliest years, the drums were silent in the room we shared with Honoré, the other slave, but they were often taken out. Madame Delphine, my mistress then, did not want to hear the black's noise, only the melancholy laments of her clavichord. Mondays and Tuesdays, she gave classes to girls of color, and the rest of the week she taught in the mansions of the Grand Blanc, where the mademoiselles had their own instruments because they could not use the ones the mulatto girls touched.
That's Isabel Allende reading from her latest novel, Island Beneath the Sea. Isabel, this notion of the drums, the music, you know, devil music, and later in the book, the notion of voodoo, you know, these are the very things that people like the Reverend Pat Robertson talk about when he says the evidence of why it's plagued with devastating earthquakes. How did you want to talk about these aspects of culture?
Because that's the most fascinating part of the culture. It's what kept what united the African slaves. They came from different places in Africa. They were usually kidnapped by other Africans and sold in the coast to the whites. And they made a point of separating people from the same village so that it wouldn't be together. By the time they got to the Caribbean, to the different islands, and to Saint-Domingue in particular, they had had a very hard voyage. They were traumatized. They had lost a lot of weight. And they got there and they were sold to the plantations where they were expected to live for a very short time. And they didn't share with other slaves, often not even the language or the religion. But what kept them together was first the desire for freedom, despair. And they communicated with the drums and the music. The only moments they have in which they felt free, they felt they were back in Africa, they felt in the body, was when they could dance. So the calendas were really important. And in the calendas, it was the drums. And in the rhythm of the drums, often they would fall in a trance. And then the loas, the gods, would possess them, mount them. And the experience of being mounted by the god is so empowering that they felt that they could do anything after that.
What did you find out then about the role that Voodoo actually played in the slave revolt and why it was successful?
A very important role. The slaves truly believed that when they died, their souls would go to the island beneath the sea. And that was Guinea paradise, where they had come from. They had many of the people who were brought from Africa had never seen the ocean before. So they thought that to go back to the dream world of before, they had to go under the sea to the island beneath the sea. And when they died, the spirits were there. So when they were fighting against the troops of Napoleon, they would summon the spirits. And they thought that for each one of them that was fighting against the soldiers, there would be 10,000 spirits that had risen from the island beneath the sea to fight with them. The empowerment of voodoo was really important. And also, it kept alive the knowledge of herbs, plants, medicine. So all that was part of the survival thing they had.
Did you find when you went to Haiti now that it's, voodoo still plays that kind of strong role, or has it become more of a tourist thing?
I have not been in Haiti recently, but I think that in the rural areas it is absolutely a religion, and one needs to respect that as a religion. It has one God only, Papa Bon Dieu, and the loas are like the saints in the Catholic Church. I have the greatest respect for the religion and the beliefs. I have seen Candomblé and people in trance in Brazil, where it's not the same, but there is much of that element, the same idea of the orishas, and it's extraordinary.
Do you believe in magic?
I believe that the world is a very mysterious place. I don't have an explanation for most of the stuff that happens. I can't understand a telephone. How would I understand coincidences, premonitions, dreams, emotions? Sometimes the world is mobilized into a war because someone has fear. What is fear? Fear is just an emotion. So there is a lot that we don't see, that we don't control, and we can't explain. And I'm open to all that, not only in literature, but in my life too.
How did you research the sort of upstairs, downstairs lives of slaves and masters in Haiti? Do slave chronicles from that time actually exist?
Yes, and there are some slave accounts of the time that were put together by abolitionists at the time. I read, of course, letters and documents of the time and history books, but also novels about that time. You know, in the history books, you get the official story written by the whites. What is interesting is the lives of the people who were defeated, the people of color, the children, the women, the old people. That's what interests me as a novelist.
And in the history books, do you get characters like Violette Boisier, who is the...
No, you don't. You don't.
Well, you should describe who she is, and you can explain about the dove's egg, if you like.
Okay, well, Violette, actually, in Haiti, among those free people, some people of color, the affranchis, and some white people, there was a group of courtesans that were young women of color, free women of color, that made a living with sex. They were trained in the arts of being a courtesan, and they usually had to make a lot of money at the beginning of their career, which was when they were 15, and then afterwards it was over. They were replaced by a new wave of young adolescents. And in my book, I have this woman called Violette Boisier, who is one of these free women of color who is a courtesan. And her pimp is a black slave, a woman, who administers her. She's the manager. And so she spreads the rumor that Violette is so good in bed that she trains her muscles by holding a dove's egg inside her vagina and not breaking it. She goes to the market. She can mount a horse with this thing inside and nothing. Okay, I sort of made that up.
Well, you have...
It wasn't in any history book.
What was the role that slaves like Zarite played when the slave rebellion actually swept through Haiti?
It's also very complicated because there were 60 shades of color in Haiti according to how much white or black blood you had. And anybody who lived in the colony could immediately at first sight say in which of those 60 categories the other person belonged. There were the free ones and the ones that were not free. And in the relationships, it also depended on if you were a domestic slave or a field hand. The domestic slaves were much closer to the white family than to the slaves in the fields. And usually when there was an attack on the plantations and they would burn the plantation, they would kill the domestic slaves because they didn't trust them. And on the other hand, the whites that escaped Saint-Domingue often brought their domestic slaves because some of them were even concubines or children, their children.
Author Isabel Allende's new book is Island Beneath the Sea. She spoke with New America Media's Sandeep Roy. This is New America Now. I'm Shireen Sadeghi. Friend us on Facebook. Just search for New America Now Radio. Last week, the youngest son of the late Shah of Iran reportedly committed suicide in his Boston apartment. Ali Reza Pahlavi was 44 years old and one of the few remaining members of a royal family that ruled Iran for nearly 54 years until the last Shah of Iran was deposed in a popular revolution in 1979. Here in California, the suicide has had a noticeable impact on the Iranian-American community, which is the largest in the United States. Mahnaz Badihian is a well-known poet of the Iranian diaspora, who also happens to be editor-in-chief of Iran's most censored online literary magazine, mohmag.org. Her magazine has been watching the aftermath closely. Welcome to the show, Mahnaz Badihian.
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in your show.
From what you've seen and read, what has the response been to the Pahlavi death in the Iranian-American community?
Well, of course, the first time that everyone received the news, it was extreme shock to everyone. And one of the reasons was that we actually, all these years, we never heard about Ali Reza Pahlavi as much as we heard about the rest of the family member of the Shah of Iran. All by sudden, we are seeing a picture of this young man with the bad news, and I think it was extremely heartbreaking and sad for the Iranian community in diaspora.
How is the Pahlavi family perceived amongst Iranian Americans?
First of all, there are a group of people that are still very loyal to Shah of Iran, and maybe some of them, they even have very close ties or relationship with them. But generally speaking, at the beginning of revolution, people had different views towards Pahlavi dynasty and Reza Pahlavi and the rest of them. But as the years went by and the things in Iran got really bad and looked bad, people end up looking back and re-evaluating their views about Pahlavi. And kind of, this is a general idea that I can say 90% or something, this is just a rough idea. By that, I mean majority of people, they don't have that very bad feeling that they had at the beginning of revolution, I can say.
So the Pahlavis are well-liked amongst Iranian-Americans?
I think even if they are not well-liked, they are liked by Iranian people, yes.
How is the Iranian-American media in this country reacted to the death?
I actually watched few of the channels that they have the most viewers, and then I saw that people calling to that station, and they are actually sending their condolences, and people are very upset. I think even the population in Iran, people in Iran or in Europe or everywhere else, everyone, this was a very heartbreaking news that a young prince killed himself. When someone kills himself, that means the things are really, really bad and ugly in their life.
After the suicide was announced, the Pahlavi family released a statement which many Iranian Americans felt was too political. Let me read you a bit of that statement. They said, like millions of young Iranians, Alireza Pahlavi was deeply disturbed by all the ills fallen upon his beloved homeland. Although he struggled for years to overcome his sorrow, he finally succumbed. A lot of Iranian Americans feel that the family tried to make the death into a political statement.
I believe what Iranians think about that, and I think that's the truth. First of all, he was a prince that never, they gave him opportunity to, you know, to talk or to have his opinion anywhere. And also for these people, someone who's in that position, you know, he was a son of king of Iran. They come here, they are in exile. They have different life. They cannot have life like regular people, average people have. They cannot have just a girlfriend or boyfriend like anyone they like. They cannot just have any job. But this young man actually was very impressive that he was highly educated and he was very smart. So what his brother Reza Pahlavi said is a little bit hard for people to actually go by that and accept that it was because of exile and because of death of his father or sister. Because this is not the problem just that happened to Ali Reza Pahlavi. Many Iranian people, they have loved ones died, killed in war or killed by Iranian regime, and they are in exile, but they live their normal life. The problem was that this young man couldn't be a prince and couldn't be a regular person, and that was the problem here, the trouble here.
Well, you mentioned the word exile. What has exile meant for Iranian Americans? I mean, this death has, for many of them, it seems, sort of reinvigorated that sorrow of exile.
Well, people all around the world, they make that decision that if they want to leave their motherland and go live somewhere else. But if you have to leave because of political situation and because of the chaos in your country, that's another story. We call it exile, and exile is something that doesn't have happy sound in it. It's just something that coincides with pain and being far from your motherland. And for Iranians especially, that they come from totally different culture, and the unity and closeness of people in the society with the family, it is a little bit more difficult to leave that kind of life and move to totally different kind of lifestyle. That's what we mean by exile.
Thank you for joining us today, Mahnaz Badihian.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
Mahnaz Badihian is a poet and editor-in-chief of MahMag.org, Iran's largest online literary magazine. For more information, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. You're listening to New America Now, dispatches from the New Majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Shireen Sadeghi. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. Mouth might sound like something to avoid, but Monique Trong's second novel introduces the reader to a young girl who possesses synesthesia, a condition giving words very specific flavors. We are taken through our protagonist's life as she deals with family, friends, and her synesthesia. She spoke with New America Media's Andrew Lam.
Monique Trong, welcome to New America Now.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure because, you know, we've been friends and I've been admiring your work. And, you know, you're also the one who did this anthology that put my work in Watermarks. And, of course, it's been a good friendship since then. But let's talk about Bitter in the Mouth, because the one thing that fascinated the most in the story, of course, is the synesthesia. So there are so many secrets in the book, and I don't know where to begin because I might reveal too many secrets for people who haven't read it. So it's probably best if you talk about it.
Okay. The main character of Bitter in the Mouth is named Linda Hamrick, mm-hmm. and she has a neurological condition that causes her to taste words. But as you... wisely noted, there are many things that set Linda apart from her family and from her little small town. And she only tells us of them gradually. So it's a very sort of gradual unfolding okay. of a person.
Well, let's have a little passage and then we'll talk.
Okay. I'll read from the beginning. I fell in love with my great uncle Harper because he taught me how to dance. He said that rhythm was allowing yourself to feel your blood coursing through you. He told me to close my eyes and forget the rest of my body. I did, and we bopped our non-existent selves up and down and side to side. He liked me because I was a quiet child. He showed me photographs of himself as a boy. He referred to himself in the third person. This here is Harper Evan Birch, he would say. The boy in those photographs was also a quiet child. I could tell from the way that his arms were always flat by his side, never akimbo or raised high to the North Carolina sky. We were both compact, always folding ourselves into smaller pieces. We both liked music, because it was a river where we stripped down, jumped in, and flailed our arms around. It was 1975 then, and the water everywhere around us was glittery with disco lights. My great uncle Harper and I, though, danced to Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Fats Domino. We twisted, mashed potatoed, and winked at each other whenever we opened our eyes. My great uncle Harper was my first love. I was 7 years old. In his company, I laughed out loud.
That's lovely. The book unfolded slowly like an onion. It's not one of those, fast forward moving, but more like so slow Camille sipping narrative in which you reveal a little bit more with each chapter. What made you decide to tell it that way?
I think it is, for me, a kind of realism, you know? I think of it in that way because I'm writing in the first-person voice. And I do feel that when we tell our stories, we're not always linear in our structure. We overemphasize some things and we underplay other things. And I believe that we don't always say everything until we feel safe. And I feel that that's very much the way that Linda's character, her personality, that's how it's structured and that's how it functions.
Well, you did research on that particular condition, so talk about that. And how difficult is it to convey someone who has synesthesia in the written words?
Well, I first heard about synesthesia from just a television show. And I saw interviews with people with various forms of synesthesia. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, there are forms that are, for example, you see text and every letter is in a different color. Mm-hmm. Or you hear music and you see colors, mm-hmm. right? But the moment that I saw this interview with a British man who has auditory gustatory synesthesia, which is tasting words, I was hooked. I knew that that's where I wanted to go with my next work. And In terms of the difficulties of sort of communicating, you know, Linda's experience on the written page, I came up with a solution, which is basically I have, when there is quoted dialogue, you have the word, and right next to it, you have in italics the flavor, right? Which, you know, I mean, makes for difficult reading sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I actually tried to not do a lot of dialogue in the first half of the book because I felt like you needed to be invested in Linda before you would want to struggle through what it is that she struggles through.
Well, give us an example of what words she heard and what does she taste.
Oh, okay. Well, her first name, Linda, makes her taste mint. Mm-hmm. So she's Linda Mint. her last name, Hamrick, makes her taste root beer.
That's interesting because did you explore, imagine yourself with that symptoms and imagine what if there's a foreign language and how would that play itself out in terms of taste? Because, you know, she did speak another language at the beginning, but we don't need to go too far into it. But.
Right. Well, I think that I'm going to answer your question this way, which is not direct, but around, I think, which is that I think that when we learn a foreign language or when we are, you know, we immigrate to a different country and we have to speak a different language. Language then becomes this very self-conscious thing. It's no longer something, you know, that you're born with, right? And so they, for me, words are objects, you know? And so I like to turn them around. Yeah. I like to examine them from every angle. And I think that in a way that made me sort of more fascinated with someone with a condition like this, where words are all of a sudden, you know, the carrier of something totally different.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, in the book, the second part of the book, there's more revelation in terms of who she really is or where she really came from. Did you think people would be taken by surprise because there was not any inkling necessarily, if you're not necessarily a Vietnamese American reader? what clue did you give people, you know, to be revealed by the real biography of this young lady?
Ah, well, I did try to seed the first half of the book with you know, the clues to sort of the unfolding that happens in the second half. You know, there are certain things like I have the grandmother saying to her, "You little canary," you know, and which can be a term of endearment, right? A little odd, right? But then once you've, you know, once you reach that midpoint and you understand more of Linda's history, you understand that the little canary has such a potentially awful meaning.
Sure, like canary in a coal mine.
Right. Or just a little yellow being.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting because, you know, we spoke at an event in Southern Cal recently, and you talk about being a Southern writer in many ways.
Right. Well, I like to say, And I think of myself as a Southern girl twice over, right? By that, I mean I was born in Saigon in South Vietnam, and then I was raised, you know, or I grew up in Boiling Springs, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the former fact that most people, you know about me or can, you know, deduce about me. But the second is something that if I wanted to, I could always keep as a secret, you know, like Linda.
Yeah. Although you do have a little twang when you speak, I think, despite the years in New York. but what I would find, say, of interest to me, because I have a similar goal as yours, I think, is that you spoke about putting Vietnamese in the public space, in the space of the imagination, in the work that we do is in the literary world, is that you populate that world that otherwise had been marginalizing, you know, people like us, Vietnamese, from history, really. Talk mm-hmm. about that.
Well, I think, you know, my first book, The Book of Salt, is probably the clearest example mm-hmm. of that effort, which is to Vietnamese, to introduce a Vietnamese character into the imagination mm-hmm. of the American reading public, but one who lives and is part of a world that precedes the American involvement in Vietnam, mm-hmm. right? Because as you know, we were colonized by the French many, many years yeah. before the U.S. ever
came in.
Right. So, you know, in that way, it was my way of reminding people that Vietnam has a long history. Mm-hmm. It did not just begin with the Vietnam War.
Your background seems to parallel in some ways with Linda's. Linda left the South and went to New York and became a lawyer. You left the South, went to New York and became a lawyer.
Right. But I suppose unlike Linda, it was not a straight shot from North Carolina to New York. My family made some really just spectacularly bad moves. I mean, bad in the sense of, you know, lack of multiculturalism kind of move. You know, from North Carolina, we went to a small town in Ohio.
Wow.
And then Houston, which was, of course, very multicultural. Mm-hmm. But for me, it felt like a bad move mm-hmm. just because by that time, I had no idea that I was Vietnamese. Do you know? I mean, I really didn't understand that. I mean, even though that's why I was always, you know, the odd one out. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what it meant to be Vietnamese American, though, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're exploring that in some way now, aren't you? I mean, in your own way.
In my own way, right.
You were called a pioneer by one professor the other day. Do you feel that there is a pressure on you being a Vietnamese-American writer to make a statement of some sort about your history or your community through your literature?
I don't feel that pressure because I know that I could never live up to something like that. So I can only write the kind of stories that I want to read, you know, and that I want to share with people. And I can only be, you know, this person that I am with all my flaws. So to think that someone would hold me up as an example of anything more than what I am, I'm like, go ahead, hold me up, but I'm going to be heavy.
How difficult was it to give up being a lawyer? Because you were a practicing lawyer. And to become a full-time writer, which is a big risk. Talk about that.
Right. Well, I stopped practicing law full-time in, I think it was 2001. And so I've been writing and managing to pay my bills and keeping myself clothed with my writing. And it is, I mean, I never know from year to year what my income source is going to be, you know. But to me, that pressure I can handle. The pressure of working in a profession that I just really despised, that I could not handle any longer.
Well, thank you, Monique, for coming, and good luck with your future endeavors.
Thank you, Andrew.
Monique Trong's new book is Bitter in the Mouth. She spoke with New America Media editor Andrew Lamb. You're listening to New America Now. I'm Shireen Sadeghi. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. The rampage in Tucson has spurred a round of finger-pointing among politicians of all stripes. This week, New America Media's Sandeep Roy joined essayist Richard Rodriguez in a conversation about what struck them as the larger story behind the headlines. What does our reaction to Arizona tell us about us?
Sandeep, we're a few days away from the horrific events in the parking lot outside of Safeway in Tucson. There's been so much said about talk radio and the rhetorical violence in America. I just wondered what you're thinking in the aftermath of
these events. Well, Richard, it's hard sometimes to make sense about something that feels so horrible and nonsensical in some ways. But a few things did strike me, and I wasn't so much interested in drawing this straight line between Sarah Palin's maps and what drove this particular killer. But three things that struck me as sort of ironies is, one is Arizona itself. The fact that in this state, it would have been perfectly legal through SB 1070 for a policeman to pull this person over had he been Latino, dressed kind of shabby, worn the wrong shoes. But even if they had seen the bulge of a semi-automatic weapon under his jacket, it would have been illegal to pull him over even for questioning. That was one thing that struck me. The other thing that struck me is the fact that the 20-year-old intern who is credited with possibly having saved Gabby Gifford's life.
An intern on her staff.
He'd just been working 5 days. He is both Latino and he's gay. Two constituencies that politicians have beaten up on again and again and used as this symbol of everything that is wrong with America. And, you know, this is America's American values are threatened because of these groups. And it was especially...
Is that being played up in Arizona? Or?
A little bit. I saw a lot of the gay... I mean, he's openly gay and he's talked about it and he's a member of a gay organization. And it was kind of strange to see Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, no friend to either Latinos or gays, leading a standing ovation for this young man. And I was reading about this in contrast to what happened in, I guess, when there was the attempt to assassinate President Ford in San Francisco, the woman Sarah Jane Moore. She was also deflected by a gay man. He was outed. His mother never spoke to him again. Yes. He tried to sue Herb Cain at San Francisco Chronicle. And so in some ways, it's changed.
His life became a calamity through the act of heroism. I remember that story, yeah.
And so those are the two things. But the third thing that struck me, and I sort of wanted your thoughts on that, is that, you know, not that long ago in Pakistan, a man who is described as sort of a moderate centrist politician is gunned down in a marketplace in public in broad daylight. And the narrative that came out of it is about a nation that is falling apart. You know, next step, nuclear weapons in the hands of al-Qaeda. It's something systemic about Pakistan. In the United States, when that same scenario repeats itself, the rush is to find out, make sure that this person acted alone, that he's just the rotten apple, that there's nothing that's wrong systemically. And I just found that kind of curious as to how quickly we go in those directions.
You know, my own opinion is that I suppose I side with the conservative line now that Sarah Palin did not pull the trigger, and that the kind of rhetorical hijinks that the right has been involved in, even the gun metaphors and the reload and all that stuff, cannot exactly be said to have killed those people in the parking lot. But it does seem to me that there is a kind of looniness in America right now that this kid is not exactly representative of, but also participates in as an American. I mean that there is just this kind of pleasure that Americans are getting in this conversation on talk radio, and on Fox News and on MSNBC, with this entertainment called conservatives versus liberals. It goes on 24 hours a day, every day. It's at a pitch now that could be described as hysterical, and it suggests to me that Americans now are at a time in which the world is so clearly dangerous, and we feel in some sense so vulnerable to it, whether it's Muslim terrorism or Mexicans crossing the border with as mules with drugs on their backpack, at a time in which we feel so vulnerable with the world, we've decided to have this kind of internal conversation about America, about the right and the left. I remember it was 2 days after September 11th, 2 days, Rush Limbaugh went back to the old script. There was so much to say about the world, but suddenly he just went back to this old, well-rehearsed speech about liberals. And we returned to that speech.
Why do you think that is? I mean, what were the sort of difficult questions that you think this at least gave us an opportunity to wrestle with, and why are we unable to have this conversation?
Well, at least one of them we'd be discussing is not whether or not Barack Obama is a Muslim, but, for example, this scandal right now having to do with the National Rifle Association. The NRA is protecting the identity of those gun shops and the gun shop owners throughout the Southwest that are basically supplying the high-tech gunnery to the gangs in Mexico. And those same weapons that are being used against border patrolmen. The inability of the conservatives on Fox, and I use the term conservatives loosely. I'm not sure that's the term we should be using for these people, but I'll use it because that's the term they use to describe themselves. The inability of those people to talk about our impact on the world is what's missing in this conversation. All we get in this conversation of liberals versus conservatives is this notion that it all takes place in America, and there is no sense of how we are playing on the world. There's no sense that we may be a player in the world and that some of what's going on against us is in part our doing. That's what seems to be missing in all of this.
What do you make of the calls then? You know, even Roger Ailes at Fox said that, I've asked them to tone down the rhetoric. And so it seems like in the end, the best that could come out of, you know, if this is a moment when people can come together, the best that we can ask for it is to tone it down.
Well, what's telling, though, is when Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, says tone it down, what he's implying, of course, is that it's all stage directed and that this is not being run by Glenn Beck or Sean Hannity. It's really an entertainment that's corporately funded and that is profitable. It is profitable to Fox, to News Corp. It is profitable to GE. It's profitable for Disney. It's profitable for for Comcast, which is going to soon be the owner of MSNBC. They are the people who are making this argument possible. If they wanted to end it, it would end, because they're paying the bills. Because they do not want it to end, because they are making a profit, it goes on.
And we have to end right now. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks.
New America Media's Sandeep Roy in conversation with Richard Rodriguez, author of Brown, The Last Discovery of America. Listening to New America Now, dispatches from the new majority. Inter-ethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. New America Now is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericanow.org. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Inga Bookbinder produces the show. New America Now is produced at the KALW Studios in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shireen Sadeghi.